Yes, indeed. Welcome to the dark. And it is time for yet another episode. Yay! I know I'm excited. This episode actually is one that is or has been requested on our Facebook page. I mentioned it a little bit in one of the other earlier episodes, and someone, a couple people actually, went on our Facebook group, not a page, a group. I have to be technically correct. I don't know. I didn't grow up with social media, so forgive me. Anywho, I mentioned it in one of the other shows, and a couple people on the Facebook group said, hey, that's a great idea. Why don't you do an episode on direction? You know, we all think about haunt actors and haunt designers and people who build haunts. What we don't think about too often is, what does a haunt director do, and do I really need one? And if I don't have one, is there, you know, as an owner, is this something that I should probably step up and fill the bill for? I'm going to let you decide the answer to that question as to whether you need one or not. I personally think you absolutely need a director, and I'm going to explain during the course of this particular episode why and what is so important about this really somewhat unseen element to most haunted attractions and you know, theater in general. Before I get too much into that, I should probably point out that this episode probably sounds a little bit different than some of my other episodes, because I am not in my luxurious home studio. That's also why this will not be on YouTube, because I don't have my camera with me, but I am in my high-tech remote studio, which basically means I'm sitting in my Mazda 3 in a parking lot, so things will sound a little different. But thanks to modern technology, I am able to record, and you're probably asking yourself, Scott, why are you sitting in a car in Florida when it's 90 degrees outside recording a podcast? And the, you know, I could make up something really wonderful, and that's really the joy of podcasts or, you know, audio entertainment in general. I could lie through my teeth and you'd never know the difference. But the truth of the matter is, I'm between meetings, and I had a little extra time to kill, so instead of going home, I decided to just go ahead and record another episode. So forgive the slightly reduced sound quality. Hopefully it's not too bad. And so that's why it sounds differently. And you won't hear Lucy, the demon dog, barking in the background. All right? So no Lucy. That's the trade-off. Slightly less quality audio, but no barking dog in the background. So let's get to talking about direction for haunted attractions. You know, I guess we should probably start with, what is a director? I mean, a lot of different people have different views on what a director really is and what their responsibilities are. And again, I'm not going to say that what I'm going to share here is the be-all and end-all, and that it's 100% accurate and that there is no room for anyone else's opinion. In fact, that's completely untrue. This is what I mean when I say a director for a haunted attraction, or really kind of a director for any theatrical experience, whether it's on stage or it's, you know, in a haunt or in a immersive theater piece or whatever. Here's what I think a director basically does for a theatrical experience. The director is the lens that focuses the light that everybody else brings to the project. And I know that's kind of a little bit, you know, earthy, crunchy, out there, metaphorical, but think about, the director is the person who takes all of the sunshine that is shining out there and focuses it into a tight little beam that has the power to burn ants. I don't know, if you ever a kid who had a magnifying glass, I'm sure you did that horrible, horrible thing, but or burn a hole in a piece of paper. You know, it takes a bunch of random creativity and focuses it into something that is really impactful and really important. Now, all too often, I have run into some directors in my career who don't believe that their job is to focus the sun. They believe they are the sun and the rest of the universe revolves around them. That is clearly not true. A good director is someone who is able to recognize that their work is to make everyone else's work look better. Their job is to keep everybody on track. You know, the idea is that the director is the person who maintains the artistic integrity, or alters it if, you know, is necessary, but is responsible for the artistic integrity of the piece. Is the product that you end up with the same one that was talked about when you were all sitting around having drinks going, hey, let's do a haunt? Because I think so many haunts do start that way, with alcohol. And that's probably why they continue that way with alcohol. Anywho, the idea is that the director is the one who kind of takes the, hey, let's do a pirate haunt that's all about the pirates who have passed on and are sailing in a ghost ship. Yes, I know this is Pirates of the Caribbean, but and then they make sure it stays that from beginning to end, and they don't start introducing clowns and Freddy Krueger, and you know, they just kind of keep tabs on the artistic integrity, so it keeps everything focused. And then, in my opinion, the director is also the person who takes direct responsibility for the live performers. They do work with all of the other designers as well. They definitely keep, you know, open and honest communication going with them. But the director is most responsible for the live performers. And we'll talk about not just what the director does, but how do they do it. We'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in just a second when it comes to the actors. Basically, in my opinion, and again, my opinion for whatever it's worth, my opinion, the director is sort of the creative buck stops here kind of guy. In other words, if something goes awry creatively, it hasn't been communicated to the lighting designer that there is a performer here, so therefore that performer is standing in the dark. That's the director's responsibility. Yes, the lighting designer should read the script or the venue flow and know what's going on, but it is the director's responsibility to make sure that all of the elements, all of the parts come together and stay focused and create something amazing and terrifying and true to the vision that was there from the beginning. I've been very lucky because in many, many cases, I direct pieces that I wrote. So, you know, I don't have to go back to the writer and say, hey, you know what, I want to change this because, you know, this happened in rehearsal or we discovered this. There are times where no Lucy, but we do have a motorcycle outside. I don't know whether you can hear that or not. Yep, there it is. Anyway, I have had times where in the past, directors would have to go back to the writer and say, hey, is it okay if we change this or alter this? There are also writers who will say, you know what, I wrote it, you've got it now as director, you make the best choices. It's really up to you, but I think it's important to identify who has that final say. Someone has to have the final say from a creative standpoint. Obviously, the people who sign the checks ultimately have the final say, but as a director, it is your job also to, you know, if you're working in a more of a corporate setting, I realize some of you, you know, if you're a home haunter, you know, what are you going to do? Go to your husband or wife and say, I'd like to change this, please. Can I have another $75 to go to the hardware store? You know, you probably don't have to worry that much about it. But if you're in a more of a corporate setting, or you have multiple owners of a haunt, the director is also the one who has to go back and say, you know what, we thought we were going to do this. We've put it into practice, and we're having problems making it work the way we thought it was going to. Here are some other alternatives. Now, as I say, I have a very broad definition of what a director's responsibilities are. Some people may just say, I just want you to hire and train the actors. That's it. That's all you do as a director. I think that's a little short-sighted because I think all too often, the actors are doing one thing, and the scenic, and the lighting, and the audio, and are doing something else. And in many cases, and if you've been listening before, you know how I feel about this. In many cases, the actors are just told, you know, wear whatever you want, costume-wise. And if you don't have a strong director, you don't have anybody to kind of keep that in mind, or in line, rather. You don't have anybody to keep that in line, so it's all focused on the basic overall story you're trying to tell. Yes, I realize that's really the costume designer's job, but if you don't have a costume designer and everybody's bringing in their own stuff, then that falls to the director. Ultimately, in my opinion, the director is the one who is responsible for the creative success or failure of any haunted attraction or immersive piece of theater. So, we kind of talked about the responsibilities. Let's talk about practically what does a director do? Because, again, very nebulous territory. There's a lot of discussion about, well, is this the director's job? Is this the lighting designer's job? Is this the scenic designer's job? Is it the actor's job? Let's talk about what the director does. In my opinion, again, you know, it's my show, so I'm obviously sharing my opinion. If you disagree, I'm totally cool with that. But I'm going to share what my experience and my own personal feelings kind of dictate, and that is the most important job of a director is to put the right people in the right jobs, and that means casting, casting, casting. I've done shows and seminars and talks and whatever on the importance of doing auditions and how to do them and how to set up the actual audition process. So go back and listen to those. I won't get into auditions. Or, actually, you can also, if you're out in California, that's what I'm teaching at Midsummer Scream, is tips and tricks for actors and how to run auditions and the importance of them. So if you're going to be at Midsummer Scream, I think I'm July... it's either the 28th or the 29th. I'll have to check my stuff, my paperwork. But that's in Long Beach, California. Midsummer Scream. I'll be teaching a class there on for actors, tips and tricks for actors for haunted attractions and for immersive theater, because they are similar but different. But anyway, I won't go into the importance of auditions and that right now. What I will say is, as the director, you have to continually find that balance between super talented and really good people. If you cast people who are super talented but absolute jerks to work with, they will be like a poison that will spread through your entire cast and it will ruin your experience. No matter how good they are, if they're jerks, they're jerks, and they're going to ruin the haunt. So, on the flip side, if you're only hiring friends and people that you really, really like to work with, and so is so nice, they're not very good, but they're so nice, then that's going to lead you down a very negative path as well. I think a lot of casting, when it comes to, you know, the director's job, when they look at people who are either auditioning or volunteering or whatever, I think about 40 to 50% of what role you put them in is based on how they look. I know that doesn't sound fair, but, you know, I'm 6'4", and I am not tiny. I'm not a tiny person. I'm not slender. But I'm about 6'4" tall, so I'm clearly not going to play some sort of troll or gnome. It's unlikely that I will be playing a pixie in someone's haunted attraction. So whether we like it or not, 40 to 50% of the casting is based on how they look. What I look for as a director when I'm casting is people's ability and willingness to follow direction. So as part of the audition process, I usually try to change what I'm asking people to do and see how quickly they can change to follow it. I also like to do some sort of interview where you actually sit down and talk to the person and make sure they understand exactly what the responsibilities are going to be, what time they're going to need to be there, whatever other, you know, operational things you have, but how they're going to have to learn their own makeup, they're going to have to do physical and vocal warm-up so they don't hurt themselves, the rules of the house, you know, whether it's a no-touching house or whatever, explain all of that to them. And then I always like to ask people if they have any questions so that they can share information. And I'll be honest, you'd be surprised in the casting process how many people during that interview will share information that you never even thought to ask and will definitely affect whether you cast them or not. certain examples. I will give you an example of not a casting that I did, but I was actually, it was a zillion years ago when I was still performing in atmospheric theater in theme parks, and I was at an audition, and the director who was doing the casting asked somebody next to me, "So why is it that you want to work here?" And they said, "Well, I was working in a water park, and you know, the supervisor was a real jerk and treated me like crap, and so we didn't get along. He didn't like me, I didn't like him, so I thought I'd come over here and work." Okay, you realize that the majority of performance here is for children. You're auditioning for a children's theater experience in this theme park. Yeah, I know. I don't really like kids, but I need the work. Okay, so this is somebody you don't want to hire. You know, it's sort of like at a haunt if you have somebody say, yeah, I don't really like working in the dark, and I don't like to be around people who've had too much to drink. Chances are good they should not be working in a haunted attraction. I'm just saying. So make sure that when you are doing the casting, you look at the person and make sure that you're casting them in a role that they can actually play. I'll show you one of my favorite dumb casting stories. Yeah, this is my own fault. I had to cast twins. Now, for those of you who know anything about my history, you've probably figured out where I was casting twins, which theme park I was working at the time. And if you don't, look it up. No, you'll find it. Anyway, I had to cast twins, and I found these great actresses, and they auditioned at different times, and I thought they were great. I thought they could, with makeup, they could look alike. What I didn't realize, or didn't take into consideration when I was casting, was one of them was, probably 4 inches taller than the other. And not only were they twins, they were conjoined twins. Joined at the torso, or at the hip. Yeah, that was a really stupid mistake. And so again, I say, look at the physicality of the people when you're casting. If you are casting somebody, like for example, if you're casting a character that reappears over and over and over throughout the house, make sure you have a height range and a body type so that if you do casting over multiple days, you know, okay, well, they have to be between 5'8 and 5'10, and they have to be mid-range body type. They can't be too large or too small. You make sure you pay attention as the director to the physicality of who it is you're casting and what they look like. By the way, with the twins, we were able to solve the problem. We put one of the twins in very, very, very high heels and the other one in flats. So, and they were both female, so the high heels didn't quite look as strange as it might sound. So casting, first and most important job of a director, casting the right look and the right attitude and the right talent level and how that all works in balance. Also, one of the things I would recommend with casting is if you do have a separate costumer, ask them to sit in so that they can turn to you and say, "I can never get a tuxedo jacket for that 7'1" tall person," or "I will never," just so that is a very practical factor and you don't make the glaring error that's going to throw your budget way out of whack, or you have people of extreme sizes, either large or small, walking around naked because the costumer couldn't find anything for them. Casting, number one job of a director, as far as what they actually do, especially when it comes to the actors. The director should also work with the designers. In other words, once the collaborative idea has been set, work with the designers to make sure that the lighting reinforces what the actors are doing, that the scenic provides enough hiding spaces for the actors, that the guest path, one of my biggest pet peeves when designing haunts, is that the guest path winds, so you don't walk in and see a long stretch of nothing. Make it so that as you turn each corner, you see something new. It reveals something new. This probably comes from designing for theme park for so many years, where we had to basically conga line the guests through. They had to be a non-stop flow. Batching was difficult with the capacity that we had to accomplish. So that's probably why I'm real big on twisty, turny pathways. But work with your scenic designer to make sure that your actors also not only have a place to hide, but also have a place to escape. I will tell you another very stupid thing that I did as a... I wasn't a designer for this one. I was just a director, and I let it happen. We had an Egyptian-themed haunted house at Hollow Scream, and I actually had a character that was a living hieroglyphic written by somebody else. But basically what they did was they carved out where the person would stand in the wall, and the person just fit into that opening. Obviously, going back to our casting the right people of the right size, that was very important. So we get that done. What we didn't take into consideration is when a guest gets scared and they throw their hands up to try to protect them, this performer has no place to escape to. So they ended up getting hit, and on a pretty regular basis because they had no escape route. Make sure that as the director, you work with your designers to make sure that your actors are taken care of. Also, I know it's not really the director's job, but it will win you big points with your cast if the director also looks out for where are performers when and if they are on break. I'm a huge proponent of giving actors break time throughout the course of the night and having swings or double cast or whatever come in and fill in those holes, because that just keeps them energetic throughout the evening. But where do they go for their break? Are they just standing next to the person who's performing for them? That's not really a break. So if you can work it in that when you're on break, you go here to this trailer, this tent, this unused room, whatever. So work with your scenic designers to make sure that that is part and parcel to what's there. Audio designer, if you use microphones, you know, make sure that you're working with your audio designer so that you have the information the actors will need, so you can share that information with them as to how the microphone is worn, what they're supposed to touch as far as gain or what they're not supposed to touch. Most audio designers I know will actually lock the microphones so that the actor can't turn themselves up or down, and that's left to the powers that be. The director also, again, makes adjustments as needed. If something happens, you see something brilliant in the rehearsal process, and you want to change something slightly or move a character to a different location, the director is the one who should have the foresight and the insight to do that and communicate appropriately to everybody else on the team. Excuse me. I know. I always say, I'll edit that out. And I probably won't. So you'll hear me sneeze twice. Another thing that I think is, like I said, one of the primary jobs of the director is not only casting, but also training the actors. And if you have a stage manager or a lead or, somebody who's in the house every single night. Now, this may be the director as well. I don't know. It depends on the size of the haunted attraction. But if you do have a stage manager or a assistant director or actor trainer or lead or whatever, have them involved with the training as well. In large theme park scenarios where we have a multi-haunt experience, like if there's up to 6 different haunted houses and 5 different scare zones, each one of those is going to have a stage manager. And what I would actually do is I would train the stage managers first. I would train the stage managers on what I expect the actors to do, and each one of the actors in each one of the positions. I would make sure that they understood perfectly, and then I would let them train their own cast. And then I would come through as the director and polish and make suggestions. And that way, everybody who's working, all of the actors, get used to going to one person with their problems, their concerns. And you also don't have Scott said, you know, that used to be a joke at Hollow Scream. Whenever actors wanted to do something that the director or that the stage manager had told them not to do, they will always say, well, Scott said I could do this. It got to be so bad that there was a mantra that all the stage managers would use is, Scott said, and Alex agreed, Alex Crow being the genius haunt guy that he is, when we were working together, it was always, well, Scott said and Alex agreed. Well, you can eliminate all of that by training your stage managers and have them be the ones who train the actors. That way, there's no, you know, breakdown in communication. There's no fabricated communication. And so get your stage managers involved with your actor training. Make sure that you find the right balance between, you find the right balance between providing the actors with enough structure so that they know how to be successful, and yet leaving it open enough so that their input can be incorporated as well. I know that kind of sounds like a contradiction in terms, but hear me out for just a second. In order for an actor to be successful, they need to have a certain amount of structure. Think of it like you're building them a jungle gym to play on. Are they still called jungle gyms? Am I really that old? I don't know. But you're building them some sort of piece of park equipment to play on. What they do on that structure is still left up to them. And the reason I say this is because I think that actors like to be right. So when you show them, hey, this is what I'm looking for, then they immediately have a sense of success. But then encourage them to take it in another direction, a different direction, and reinforce what you like that they're bringing to the role or that they're bringing to the character. The reason I think that part is so important is because these are people who are going to play these characters all night long, night after night after night. And especially if it's immersive theater, like the Vault of Souls, when we did Vault of Souls, that was immersive theater. These people played these characters for 3 to 4 hours at a time. So they had to be enough, there had to be enough connection between them and the character so that they could believably play these roles for very, very long periods of time. It also gives the actor a sense of ownership in the character. Even when I write characters, I will say things like, here is the, you know, this is a voodoo queen, and she's domineering and powerful, and she uses spells. And then I'll insert a line that says, have the actor create 3 spells and have them tell you what those spells actually do. Again, giving ownership to the actor and also making it so that they can play them for long periods of time. So I've got enough structure so that they know kind of what the character is, but there's enough freedom so that you can take their input as well. Now, once the rehearsal process is over, then it is locked in. In other words, don't, in my opinion, don't have your actors going out and randomly changing things without any sort of outside eye looking at it. Because I promise you, usually when they do that, one of two things is going to happen. Either someone is going to get hurt, or someone is not going to be in the right place at the right time. And when I say someone's going to get hurt, it can either be the actor or the guest. Because again, the performer is doing something out of what was approved. As a director, and more importantly, as a haunt owner, that is really dangerous. Because if you don't know what your actors are doing, then you're the one who is going to have to foot the bill for the lawsuit if something happens. So make sure that you give them structure, give them freedom to develop, and then once it's developed, you say, okay, great, here's where we are. If you want to change this, it must be approved before you make any changes. And usually, if you give them enough input, they feel as though, okay, they've already made the changes they want to make. And it is possible that, you know, after the haunt opens and you actually get guests in there, you discover, oh, you know what, this might work better this way. As the director, you should be open to that. But again, once you open, once you stop your rehearsal, then that's the character, that's the way it's going to be played. Here's the 5 or 6, 10, 20 things that they can do. But don't radically change anything without getting approval from the director or from the stage manager or whatever your hierarchy happens to be. When you do lead your actors, when you direct your actors, one of the most useful tools I've ever found is directing with questions. Ask them a series of questions that, even if you have something very specific you want in your mind, if you ask them a series of questions that lead them in that direction, not only will the actor feel as though they have more ownership, they will also discover and understand the nuances and subtleties that you want them to have. In other words, you kind of take them on a journey of discovery. And there have also been times where during that questioning process, they'll discover something that's even better than I had in mind. So, for example, say I wanted this character to be played as though it was mentally stunted at the age of 7, but is hulking and quite threatening to the guests. You know, I might start off with, how smart do you think this character is? Well, he's smart enough to hurt people if he really wants to. Okay, why then doesn't he have a gun or a machine gun or a machete, or why is it just his bare hands if he's that smart? Well, maybe he's stronger than he is smart. Okay, so here he is. He's stronger than he is smart, which I really like. I think that's the right direction to go. So let's say, is he 80% strong, 20% smart? Is he 50-50? He's probably 80% strong, 20% smart. Okay, so if you were 20% as smart as you are right now, it would have meant that you stopped being smart at what age? Maybe 7 or 8. So what I've done is, through a series of questions, led the actor to understand what the character's all about and to give them a sense of ownership that they went on the journey with me, and it wasn't just me saying, he's a giant baby. Now, sometimes you may have to get to that, especially if you don't have a lot of rehearsal time, but I really do believe that if you follow or walk with the actor on the journey of discovery, you get a better product. Now, there are going to be people who say, I don't have the time to do that with every single actor. And my response is, you don't have the time not to. Again, if you have any rehearsal process at all, by doing that, you lock in the character. You make it so that you both understand who the character is and why that character is the way it is. It's a very, very beneficial approach going through questions. And you can also open it up so that the actor can ask you questions. You can say, you know, do you have any questions for me? Because as an actor, I will quite often say, okay, so are you saying that he's like a spoiled child? You know, I'll start to use analogies back so that I can better understand and put it into words and relationships that my personal experience allows me to understand. So direct with questions. It's an incredibly useful tool, and you can lead people in a certain way, or you can just go on a sense of discovery. You know, there have been characters where I've said, I just need a character here. I'm not sure what it's going to be. So during the course of the discussion, I actually develop it with the actor, and we come up with something better than I could have ever written sitting in my office. So that's pretty cool. To keep people in line, I am a huge proponent of what is called positive reinforcement. This is the way you train a dog. This is the way you train intelligent birds. This is the way you can train your husband or wife. This is the way you can train your kids. This is the way that you can train your actors. Catch them doing things right and praise them for it. Reward positive behavior. Because if all you do as a director or a stage manager or any other person of authority, if all you do is correct people when they're wrong or punish them when they're wrong, all they learn how to do is avoid being punished. Does that make sense? They may still do the wrong, but they're just not going to get caught at it. If you reinforce positive behavior, then what they try to do is to do the right thing so that they can get rewarded. It's not avoiding getting caught doing the wrong thing, it's getting caught doing the right thing. And some perfect examples of that, I always used to tell my stage managers, praise people publicly, redirect people privately. So if somebody does a great job and gets a great scare, in your end of night meeting or the beginning of night meeting the next day when everybody's putting their makeup on, say, you know, I understand that actor XYZ over here, let's just call them Marsha, that Marsha got a great scare last night. That whole big bunch of frat boys that came through, the one guy fell to the ground and started crying. And that was all because of Marsha. Good job, Marsha. So that everybody knows Marsha did a good job. Marsha feels good, and they will go to her and say, hey, how did you get the big guy to fall to the ground crying? On the flip side, say Marsha was texting back in her hidey hole, and the frat boys went by, and I was right behind them, and they didn't get a scare, and they just kind of peeked around the corner and went, hey, look, she's on her phone. That's lame. Yeah, okay. After my head exploded, then I would pull Marsha aside and say, hey, you know what? Those guys just didn't have a good time here. You missed an opportunity to scare them. Is that what you really want to do? But I would do that privately, one-on-one. So, praise publicly, redirect privately. It will make, it helps with your cast's, feeling of self-worth. It also makes them work harder for you. And again, I realize that some of you are thinking, well, I have volunteer actors, so I really can't go that deep with them. Actually, yes, you can. If you have volunteer actors, they're doing it because they love it. And if you show that you care as much about them as they care about the job that they're doing, they will do it better. And they will stick with you longer. Everybody likes some sort of positive reinforcement, especially if they're not getting paid. So make sure that you praise publicly, redirect privately. It doesn't mean be a jerk. It doesn't mean take them in the back room and beat the crap out of them. Oh, and by the way, when I say redirect privately, don't walk into a crowded room and say, excuse me, Joe, can I talk to you privately for a moment? Because everyone's going to know exactly what that means. And the whole room is going to go, oh, Joe screwed up. Uh-oh. No. Make it truly private. So it's not calling out across the room, I wanted to tell you you did something wrong, but I can't do it in front of everybody. Don't do that. Bad choice. Bad choice, Mr. Director, or Mrs. Director, or Miss Director. Miss Director? Does that mean you're a magician? Think about it. It's almost funny. So, again, positive reinforcement keeps everybody online. Just a few of the tips of the trade to handle actors and get them to do consistently, one of the most important words in haunt acting, consistently what you want them to do. If you have in your entire season 10,000 people come through your haunt, okay? If you have in your entire season 10,000 people who come through your haunt, that is 10,000 opportunities to do exactly the right thing and 10,000 possibilities that something will go wrong. So the more consistent you can be, the better your ratings will be. If everybody gets the same high-quality experience, then no one is going to get on social media and say, this house is really lame. And I think that's the director's responsibility. I think you have to set that tone with them. Another very important part of setting the tone as the director is make sure you do what you say. If you, for example, tell your cast you have to be on time, you must be on time, then make sure that when you have rehearsals, that they start on time. Model the behavior you want them to follow. If you say that, you all have to get along, or you all have to look out for the guests, or you all have to have 100% energy 100% of the time, then you as the director or the stage manager or whatever have to model that same behavior. You have to show them. Because if you say, if you're sitting on your butt in the corner, on your phone, and you're saying to your actors, yeah, you need to get out there and give 110%, just get out there and, go get them. Rawr. Oh, wait, hold on, I've got an extra life in Candy Crush. Okay, you are saying one thing and demonstrating something completely different, and the thing that you're demonstrating is far louder than the thing that you are actually saying. Because you are the director, that does not mean that you can be less invested than the actors. You must be more invested, but focused on your job. All right? Focused on your job. One of the last bits of concern I will give you in regards to directing actors, I try everything in the world not to demonstrate exactly what I want the actor to do. The only times I will do that is if I'm dealing with actors who have absolutely no acting experience and will never get there on their own. Then I will demonstrate and let them pretend to do it after me. If you have anybody who has any experience at all, if they are imitating what you do, then chances are good they're not going to do it well. Because they have no sense of ownership, they're doing a poor imitation of what you showed them how to do, and I strongly recommend against it if you can avoid it. Yes, it is a tool. Yes, it is a tool that I have used to actually give an actual demonstration of do it like this. But if you can avoid that and can get them to where you want them to be by questioning them and reinforcing when they do something right and redirecting them privately when they do something wrong, that is preferred. So please make sure that you kind of keep that in the back of your head as you're directing. So the sad and interesting thing about directors is directors are kind of, it's kind of a thankless job. The directors are the first to get blame when things don't go right and the last to get recognition when they do. The director, you know, if something just falls apart, whether it's the actor's fault or not, the director is the one who gets blamed. If an actor does a phenomenal job, they get the praise. And I'm talking primarily from the people who are coming as guests. If somebody says the whole house sucks and there was no focus, that's probably the director they're talking about. If someone says, oh my gosh, everybody just scared me over and over and over again, what a great cast. If you're the director, take that as a huge compliment. If anyone ever says, this cast works so well together, take that as a phenomenal compliment as a director. Because I think one of the most important things that you, one important thing that I think you can focus on in training is to make sure that each actor knows where they fit in the overall story of things. What is the scare that happens before them? What is the scare that happens after them? And why is their scare unique? So that they can prep the guests for the next scare, or they know what they're coming from. For an example, if you have an actor behind a drop door and they have a bright light behind them, if they know that the room before them is very, very dark, the moment that drop door hits, they know that all the guest is going to see is light. So you're going to have to make sure that you reinforce that with some sort of sound, or that you let the door drop. You may even let the door drop, let the light come through and hit them first, and then stand up into the light, so it becomes a double scare. By making sure that the actors know where they fit in the overall scheme of things, that will help them significantly, make them much stronger and much sturdier. And you as a director, it will show that you are worthwhile. It will show that you have brought those actors to a whole new level and given them the tools they need to succeed. So you may think that if you're a small haunt, you don't really need a director. And you may be right. You may be right, but someone has to take on that role. And whether that is the owner or the stage manager, or if you're a home haunt, mom becomes the director, someone has to be assigned. It is your job to make sure that the actors are working in cohesive synchronicity with the rest of everything else in the house. So you do need a director, or at least someone to take on that responsibility. That is pretty much our, I always say our, like I've got this huge staff. Yes, you, go get me some coffee. As I said already, I'm in a car. There's no coffee to be had. But that is my show on direction. This is a huge topic, and if you have any questions, again, please go to our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook. If you are a member, search A Scott in the Dark, and you will find our group, ask to join it. One of us will approve you. Let me know your comments, both positive and negative. I mean, if you think that I'm completely full of crap and you've done things a zillion years a completely different way, please open that up, because I love those kinds of discussions. this, what I say on my show is based on my experience and the way I like to work, but there may be, you know, as many different ways to work as there are people listening. So join our Facebook group and share those thoughts. If you'd like to know more or have unanswered questions about direction, again, that's the place to do it. You can also email me directly at ascottinthedark@gmail.com. But I think I will be honest, the Facebook group is probably the quickest. And then if I don't answer, somebody else might, who's part of the group. That's one of the things that is the coolest about our Facebook group, is that it's now starting its own sort of side conversations, which are wonderful and very enlightening. Speaking of enlightening, I will be all over the place in July, and I would love to meet you guys. If you are listeners and I haven't met you before, I would love to meet you in person. I will be at the Southeastern Halloween Enthusiast Convention on July 14th. It also runs on the 15th, but I'm only there on the 14th. And this is in Ocala, Florida, and it is, Bill Ramsey is putting it together, and it's got some really cool heavy hitters. You know, Robbie LaPree is back doing stuff for the circuit, and I've worked with Robbie for years. Kyle Vest is there. Tater is there. It's just a bunch of great speakers. I will be speaking on a panel there about haunting in theme parks and zoos and attractions, and I'll be on the panel with people from Busch Gardens and people from Universal, and I'll be representing various and sundry different places that I've done haunts, including Busch Gardens and the Vault and Zoo Tampa, and, you know, so anywho. And then I'm also teaching a class there, which I am very proud to say is based on an episode that I did a while back called Make It Cheap. So I will be doing a live presentation as part of that event on Make It Cheap, finding cost-effective ways to haunt. And once again, that's the SEHEC, or Southeast Halloween Enthusiast Convention. Halloween Enthusiast Convention. Just search SEHEC and you will find their website, and there's links on the Facebook page. There's links on my personal Facebook page. It's going to be a really cool event. If you are in the southeastern corner of the United States, or you just want to travel to Florida for a while, that's in Ocala, and that is once again July 14th and 15th. Then on the 15th, I am flying to Austin, Texas. If I have any listeners in Austin, great. I would love to see you there. It's not necessarily for a haunted attraction convention. It is for the League of Historic American Theaters Conference. And I will be teaching a seminar, or team teaching a seminar, with Jill Witecki from the Tampa Theater. And we will be teaching a seminar on how to utilize the history and ghost stories of your historic theater to generate additional revenue. I'm very excited. I get to work with Jill again. Jill is one of my dear, dear friends and playmates. She's also part of my improv company here in Tampa. So that'll be July 15th through the 19th. I'll be in Austin, Texas. Then I already mentioned Midsummer Scream, July 28th and 29th, Long Beach, California. And then on July 30th, I will be a panelist on the Seasonal Entertainment Source Leadership Symposium, and that is on the Queen Mary in Long Beach. And if you are part of that, I understand that we're going to be getting a little tour of the Queen Mary itself, and talking to the folks who do the Halloween event there, which these guys are great. These guys are wonderful. They're super talented and really fun to party with. I'm just saying that. If you are listening and you are in California and you're coming to either of those, once again, please come up and say hi. If you're listening and you happen to be friends of mine, let me know, because I'll be looking for people to go to dinner with and grab coffee with and go grab drinks with while I'm there. So please feel free to contact me. I'd love to see you all, because I don't get to see my friends on the West Coast nearly as often as I'd like to. And again, I will be there July 28th through the 30th. And then I come back to Tampa and dive into a couple of other Halloween projects, which hopefully I will be able to talk about in future episodes. If you are not a subscriber to Seasonal Entertainment Source magazine, it is a free subscription. Please join it. I write for it, so I'm biased. But I do write for it. I write for, it's a quarterly piece, and I write a new article, new series of articles called Shining a Light. And some of them are on Halloween, some of them aren't. But if you have any sort of theme park or seasonal entertainment attraction, it is a very worthwhile publication to have and share with your staff and your team. Okay, I've done all my unnecessary plugs, and I've talked a lot about direction. Again, if you have any questions or comments, please go to our Facebook page. I apologize, this will not be on YouTube, but I will try to get something up from all of the conventions that I will be going to very shortly. And so, until next time, all I can say is, rest in peace.